Hey guys, this week on Next in Marketing, I spoke to Jessica Peltz-Zatulov, founding partner of the venture capital firm Hannah Gray. Jessica and I talked about why investors are chomping at the bit to invest in startups coming out of the pandemic, as consumer behavior gets recharted and brand loyalty kind of goes out the window. Speaking of brands, Jessica says that marketers are about to feel increased urgency to move spending from platforms to people, which is not going to be easy for most, but it's increasingly vital in the creator economy. Let's get started.
Everything we know about the media, marketing, and advertising business is being completely upended thanks to technology and data. We're talking with some of the top industry leaders as they steer their companies through constant change. Welcome to Next in Marketing, presented by AppsFlyer.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Next in Marketing. My guest this week is Jessica Peltz-Zatulov. Hey, Jessica, how are you?
Hey, I'm good. How are you? Good to see you again.
Yeah, it's great to reconnect. We haven't talked in a while, but you've gone out on your own, and so you've promised that you're going to be unhinged today, which I'm excited about.
Unhinged, unfiltered. Yeah, we'll see how it goes.
So
a lot of exciting things in this space.
Yeah, we're going to have lots of things to talk about in our industry, but let's talk about who you are and what you're doing. I think I met you a bunch of years ago, and you were at VC firm, and now you're doing your own thing. Tell us what you're up to. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I grew up in the media industry here in New York City. I spent the first decade of my career working at Zenith Media and managing the media strategy for a lot of Fortune 500 brands, H&M, Gucci, Puma, 20th Century Fox, Verizon. I was really fortunate that I was running Verizon's media from 2009 to 12 when I was at Zenith, their print and their digital strategy. And so that just really gave me a front row seat in terms of mobile adoption and just the explosion of creativity coming out of the app store. And, you know, just recognizing that our strategy was moving away from the switchers between AT&T and Verizon and Sprint and more about getting people to upgrade to their data plans.
Right. They were probably always like the big spender first on things.
Absolutely. So, you know, that got me interested in mobile and emerging technology. I did the industry's first iPad sponsorships back in the day with Time Inc. and Sports Illustrated. Wow. And, you know, that really got me interested in working with mobile and emerging technology and understanding just how these changes are going to have big impacts for brands. And right. So around that time in 2012, 2011, I started getting involved in the New York tech ecosystem and just fell in love with the space and fell in love with working with entrepreneurs that just had a different lens in terms of how they saw the world. But as a non-technical female, you know, I was working with a lot of founders who were engineer guys or product guys, and they didn't know how to find their first customers.
Not natural born marketers, probably at all.
Not like the key skill set of right. founders back in the day. And so my superpower really became helping these founders learn how to commercialize their business and learn how to do branding and media strategy and paid acquisition and community building. And so I left corporate in 2012 to go to a startup myself. I was the second employee at one of the first innovation boutiques. Okay. Where big brands would hire us to help them map out the emerging startup landscape. So we were working with brands like Kraft and Unilever and Mondelez, and ultimately ended up doing some of the industry's first campaigns around influencer marketing, around mobile wallet, around connected devices. And so really just being at the center of connecting big brands with emerging technology and understanding what those implications are for your business in terms of just future-proofing yourself and your category towards how consumers are interacting with technology.
Well, back then, what kind of startups were brands thinking about? Are we talking like early social media platforms, early ad tech companies, all kinds of things?
This is a lot of like early ad tech companies. I was one of Triplelift's first customers.
Ah, okay.
Connected them to Gucci. We did the industry's first pinnable banner ads. Now, Triplelift was obviously just in the news. They sold their stick to Vista for $1.4 billion. So that was just one of the first times. I remember talking to Ari and Sean, and Ari called me and he was like, "Hi, so we got an RFP. Not sure what that means. So I just said we don't do it." And I was like, "Ari, of course you do it." And so, you know, then we kind of collaborated on how you answer that and what that means. And ultimately, it helped lead to their first customer. And so that's really when I sort of had my aha moment in terms of my background as a marketer really being a valuable contributor in the tech ecosystem. So after I left that startup, I went to MDC, and for 6 years I was running their corporate venture capital practice, investing in all early stage digital media and marketing tech companies that were addressing the needs of the modern CMO. So we looked at a lot of companies around content, around audio, around data and analytics, around commerce, things that really impacted the way brands interact with their customers and right. consumers want to interact with their brands. So left there last fall to officially launch my own venture capital firm with my partner, Kate Beardsley. And so that's where we are today. It's off to the races.
Yeah, I think we had crossed paths at your previous job when you, because you were one of the go-to people to talk about what was going on with ad tech at the time, whether it yeah. was getting a lot of investment, not at all. But I'm curious, like, for how long had you just thought about going out on your own, and then why did you do it last year? That seems like a very scary time to do it.
Why did I leave my stable corporate job to start a venture capital
right,
firm?
Right, security, when who cares?
In the middle of a pandemic, fundraising completely virtually. Yeah, I mean, I think I've always kind of aspired to start my own firm and really just have full autonomy to invest in companies and themes that I really believed were going to be transformative for the next generation. And when you're at a corporate, I mean, MDC, it's an incredibly progressive firm. I'm huge fans of the leadership and just everything they're doing. But, you know, when you're at a corporate VC, you have a mandate. You have to invest in things that are strategic to the corporate. And so as things were going on with the pandemic, and I just started to see so much creativity happening that are really addressing just the pain points and the disconnects and the problems that were just exacerbated during this rare moment in time we're in, I was basically like, I just can't sit on the sidelines and just see all this creativity and these disconnects happening and not be actively investing in the space. And so when I had the opportunity to team up with my partner, Kate, who I've known for 7 years, we're co-investors. She was actually a founding member of Lara Hippo, for those of you that don't know, one of New York's top early stage seed funds.
HuffPost, BuzzFeed, companies like that,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. So she actually used to work for Kenny Lear at the Huffington Post as his chief of staff and started doing his angel investing back in 2009-10. So, you know, she did paperless posts for them. And then when they papered Lear Hippo January 2010, the first deal she did for the fund and the fund's first deal was Venmo. And then it became Warby and Casper and Glossier. So just like could not get a better partner to team up with for this. And so what we basically recognize is that we are in a moment of disconnects where consumer behavior and worker behavior are creating huge areas of opportunity. Mm-hmm. And so as pre-seed investors, we really believe that you have to be a student of some of these cultural forcing functions that are changing the way that we interact with work, that we interact with brands, because when you're coming out of moments of crisis and entering these moments of chaos, this is when consumer behavior becomes recharted and becomes just more open-minded to try new services, new brands, new value propositions that just fit their needs at any given moment.
This is everyone's habits are up for grabs or
totally
in a way that they rarely are in
exactly. This is like a moment in time that early stage investors are just chomping at the bits because it's like all brand loyalty just goes out the window in favor of what are products or services that are just more convenient, more values aligned, more accessible. And so when we just started to see all these disconnects happening across healthcare and education and financial inclusion and future of work and commerce, they were just like, there are going to be incredible companies built for the next decade during this vintage. And we can't sit on the sidelines for it.
That's interesting. Cause I always think of you just as my former reporter lens, like you're an expert on marketing and ad tech and stuff like that, but you're not, so you're going to be in all kinds of industries. You're going to be doing consumer investments and healthcare and other things. Like, can maybe talk about the mix you guys are looking at? I know it's awfully early in your tenure here, but.
Yeah, so we're intentionally a generalist fund because we believe you you need to read the tea leaves and really just understand this intersection between technology, consumer and worker behavior, and cultural shifts. So we like to say that we're investing in customer-centric founders that are reimagining everyday experiences to improve work and life. So that, like I said, it's really spanning across.
That's everything. Like, yeah, work and life. I mean, that's a lot.
Yeah, I mean, we're not doing crypto, we're not doing life sciences, not doing biotech, but, you know, things that we know how to add value towards. But really the common thread behind all of that is, how are you innovating on the customer experience? Mm-hmm. And that's something that ties back really nicely into my background coming from the brand world, and also Kate's coming from Huffington Post. And she also started her career working for Martha Stewart. So just, we have a really deep appreciation for creating delightful customer experiences and understanding how community is really, and education are really the new acquisition channels, no matter what brand it, no matter what sector that you're in,
right.
Whether that's a bottoms up fintech company or an education place. And so we're applying a lot of those learnings from our operating experience to build these next generation of businesses, no matter what the sector is.
I want to get into the media and ad world in a second, but is there an industry, we constantly talk about how this last year has accelerated digitization in every pretty much everywhere. Is there a sector that would we be surprised? Oh, you don't realize how much healthcare would not be one surprise, would not be that surprising, but what's an area that's going to see a lot of change that we're not thinking about as much maybe?
Oh my gosh. I mean, there's going to be huge changes around education, around healthcare. I mean, we've been spending a lot of time in the future of work. And I think the future of work can be divided into two core themes. And you know, one of those themes is really around, how do you unbundle the office? Like, COVID has really changed worker expectations, right? Mm-hmm. So it's changed expectations just around just tangible expectations, right? So what are going to be the protocols for vaccines? What about bathrooms of choice? Like, what are remote hiring and onboarding practices? But then it's also changed, there's been cultural shifts that have changed just emotional worker expectations, right? Like, how do you support parents? What kind of mental health benefits are you providing? How are you facilitating upskilling and different employee education? You know, do you have bias training, diversity and inclusion practices? And so this kind of creates this intersection of tangible and emotional worker expectations that are just like grounded in ethics, I think, which again just goes to, how can you best recruit and retain top talent by really understanding what your value proposition needs to be as an employer?
Right.
And so I think there's going to be a lot of innovation just around how you break down the components of work. You know, that can be everything around communication tools, around collaboration tools, around education, around culture. So kind of this like unbundling of the office is a really interesting facet. But then the other side of that coin is around the creator economy.
Yes.
Which obviously then some people will say, whatever, it's the YOLO economy, it's the passion economy, it's a side hustle economy, like whatever. There's like a lot of different ways that it's being coined right now. But the reality is that in 2027, they're projecting that America will be a majority freelance economy. And there are so many interesting underlying just tensions that are bubbling up under the surface.
I immediately think of health insurance.
Accelerating all of this.
You're probably thinking of a lot of other things.
Yeah, I mean, it's health insurance, but it's also just recognizing that, like, if you look at the forcing, we use this word forcing functions a lot, clearly, but mm-hmm. but it's like coming out of the last economic recession, the gig economy really started to explode, right? Like coming out of that, when a lot of people were out of work and you had to cobble together your income.
Yeah, you were an Uber driver, but you also had a Starbucks gig, you know, all those kind of
exactly,
things.
Exactly. But the foundation of the gig economy was really around commoditized skills, right? It was like, can you drive a car? Can you run an errand for TaskRabbit? Can you shop for groceries with Instacart? So like that whole movement around the gig economy.
Not the professionalized skills, the specialists necessarily.
Right. Well, it's not only specialists, it's around creativity. So that was a whole movement. Obviously, like there's a ton of reasons that worked and a ton of reasons that didn't work. Mm-hmm. But if we fast forward to today and this moment that we're in right now of people being furloughed indefinitely, people having seen their parents get laid off in the maybe the past financial crisis, but it's accelerated by Gen Z and this desire to monetize their creativity and have self-expression, and just like a general skepticism around the need for a traditional career path, mm-hmm. and just not wanting to be replaceable by being part of a larger system. So that has really spun just this huge acceleration of wanting to control your own income, you know, elevate diverse voices, like kind of break down some of these old guard power systems that traditionally would create barriers for a lot of diverse talent. And so there's a lot of this tension that is bubbling up in the workforce, that a lot of the innovation we're seeing is around how do you create technology infrastructure that's both horizontal to meet worker needs. So that's things like your benefits, your infrastructure, your back office, but that it's coupled by all this vertical, all these verticalized hustler platforms, whether you're a writer, a teacher, a podcaster, an artist, mm-hmm. there's just a huge host of new platforms that are facilitating monetizing your own creativity, that when coupled with new solutions that are just meeting the more horizontal, like traditional worker needs, it's going to completely change the workforce. And so I think that that's just going to have a lot of different implications for brands as they think about new competition, both competition for their products, but also competition for talent and recruiting talent. So obviously, like a lot of wormholes we can.
I have a couple in mind. So let me ask you a stupid broad question. Why do we make a distinction? I think I know this, but between we would talk about influencers or digital creators, and that meant, you know, usually that meant the top couple hundred or thousand creators on a YouTube or a Instagram. And those are people that produced every day for those platforms or very frequently. And now we're talking about the creator economy, which is some of that, but it's a little bit, I think, broader and definitely different. Why do we make the distinction? What's the distinction in your mind? And then what does this mean for brands?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the way that I think about it is, not all influencers are creators and not all creators are influencers.
Okay.
There's a pretty big distinction there. Influencer marketing, we've barely scratched the surface. And so where I see a huge white space is that I believe there's going to be this increased urgency for brands to migrate spending from platforms to people. And what I mean by that is, every time I see a startup that's just doing paid social, I'm like, cool, that's a race to the bottom and just not interesting.
You're basically an intermediary you can buy this on the same tools everybody else gets to use on these APIs, and it's not a big deal.
Yeah, it's just like the need, it's a very shallow interaction for customer acquisition, right? Like you're not really able to create an authentic connection with your customer. And so it becomes education and community as the new acquisition channel. And right. That really comes with investing in your people. And so when I think about influencers, I believe that that what brands aren't going to see coming is that we're going to see this huge movement of what I've been calling C2C commerce, which I'm framing as creator to community.
Okay.
And so how I'm sort of seeing the influencer marketing space morph and mature into the creator economy is, when this movement first started back around, call it 2012, 2014. I mean, I literally think I looked at least 60 companies in the influencer space between 2014 and 2017. Like, it was just bonkers for a while.
Are you talking about companies that were trying to like make influencer marketing more programmatic or platforming to some extent?
Yeah, exactly. Like helping with discovery, helping with
analytics,
management, helping with analytics, like yada, yada. Like, the space just got incredibly crowded.
Even though it's inherently difficult to do that, right? Like, it's
inherently, absolutely. And there's been a few breakouts in the space. I'm really bullish on Aspire IQ as one that's really breaking out. Hyper obviously did too. But where influencers started is, it used to be brands would finally get the courage to give creative license to their products and to their messaging to influencers.
Right. So super scary,
but they got over that hump, which was, which was a huge win. I actually remember doing one of the first influencer campaigns, with P3, Meat, Cheese, and Nuts. It was a craft brand and a startup called Sumpto that was in the college influencer space with Vines. And we had this hypothesis that, you know, okay, let's see how the beautifully produced 30-second spots that we're going to have a ton of paid social behind performs against giving the product to 20 college influencers that were like going to create stupid content on Vine. And obviously the stupid content on Vine just crushed it. It completely crushed it and just performed off the charts. And so that's when we kind of knew we were onto something. And so where the migration of influencer marketing has gone and where I believe it's going is it started out where brands would contract the influencers to create content for them, right? So that was kind of the first layer is here's some products, make me a cool TikTok video, make me some Instagram, make me a YouTube video, cool. Or it would be, can you push my content out to your followers? So can you syndicate my content?
Yep.
And then it kind of became, all right, well, let's try to do some affiliate links, where, you know, creators started to say, hey, I'm promoting your product, but I'm not getting a cut of any of this. And so then there started to be some affiliate partnerships there.
Right. If somebody buys the socks I'm showing you, you get a couple percentage points. Right. Happy.
Exactly. Exactly. But now where it's going and what's really exciting for us to see and should be a little terrifying for brands to see is we are starting to see the creators become the brands themselves. And so what's fascinating is we're starting to see a lot of tools and infrastructure that's enabling influencers' content to either be shoppable, to do the distribution for them, to do the manufacturing for them, to do the back office for them.
Right.
And so now all these influencers need to do is to do their shtick, make their beautiful videos, and suddenly they just need to put a link and they have their own storefront.
Like they've got the it's like their version of Shopify for whatever is plugged in and they can just run their show.
Yeah.
So that's different than 10 years ago when a big YouTube star talked about makeup, but they didn't have all that stuff.
Exactly. But it's like a lot of them don't have the infrastructure, the bandwidth, the people power to be like, okay, let me do the product testing and then I'll be able to ship this for you and manage that distribution. And that wasn't available. And now there are tools and resources out there that's doing everything for them. So it frees up the creator's creativity to just produce the content while still having this different business on the side. And right. So the reason that's important is that these creators, they already have a megaphone with a huge following. They already have trust. They already have this authentic connection to be in the flow with their customers. They already have a feedback loop to say, what do you want me to do? Do you like this? Do you not like that? So they have all the ingredients to create a brand. So now we're seeing some creators start to say, instead of promoting that makeup brand, maybe I just become the makeup brand.
Why don't I get in that business instead? Right.
Exactly. Right. So you see creators like Michelle Pham, who, you know, would do makeup tutorials on, I think, YouTube. She has over 1 billion views.
Yep.
She started Ipsy, which now is, she's raised over $100 million. It's valued at $800 million.
And, right.
You know, you see people like the Dolan twins who founded Wakeheart, which is, it's like a gender neutral fragrance brand for Gen Z. And so if I'm L'Oreal or if I'm Coty, I'm kind of thinking.
You're already getting nipped at by the DTC brands, right? And now you got to deal with this.
Yep. Exactly. Exactly. And so if I'm an incumbent, I have to think about an entirely new set of challenger brands that have more authenticity with their customer, who's often Gen Z. And I need to figure out how I can stay relevant. And so that's why I say, like, I think we're just in the very early innings of shifting budgets from platforms to people.
Right.
Because yes, there is influencer marketing is growing and accelerating, but there are still thousands and thousands of people that are not the Dolan twins and that are not Michelle Pham. And so how can you find those people, invest in them and empower them to be part of your ecosystem as opposed to having them do it on their own.
Well, I'm sure this is probably happening, but why are we not seeing like the P&Gs, the giant packaged goods companies instead of getting them, trying to pay these influencers to talk about their products, why don't they seed some of the create new brands with these guys?
I think they should. I absolutely think they should, and I think you should see collaborations and. Right. You know, I think this rise of the micro influencers and just like I said, it's this decoupling of the workplace, particularly with Gen Z, that is such a fascinating micro trend, because it's just as a person's income becomes decoupled with a traditional job, like that whole support stack of work needs to be reimagined.
Right.
And so recognizing that there is that tenacity and that motivation and that urgency for creative expression with these creators, then brands can either embrace it and be like, let's do a collaboration together and it becomes a joint venture, or, you know, they can risk just becoming irrelevant, which is obviously, I think, what every brand is afraid of.
Now, let me push back on that a little bit. You could see a brand, particularly DCC, saying, well, listen, I have built my company by doing customer acquisition through advertising on Instagram and Pinterest and whatever, and that's fine. Why do I have to shift my strategy? Is it driven at all by the major identity shift we're seeing in advertising, where you can't do all the things you should be able to do with cookies and Apple and all that stuff?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely part of it. I mean, of course, brands have to get more creative about how they find customers, but I think that we are just in this moment of time where you have to always go back to basics of just saying, what are my customers' motivations for using and trying my product? How does that make them feel when they interact with it? And am I authentically connecting with my customers? And particularly for a lot of incumbent brands that want to connect with Gen Z, there's not that built-in category advocacy or brand advocacy.
And the creators have it and they don't.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. And so, you know, you mentioned D2C, but I think that, like, if we look at the past decade or so year of brands and some of these new challenger brands that have come out, it's like there's always this like experience innovation coupled with emotional drivers with a societal shift that creates this movement, right? Like that's kind of the perfect storm that we see. And so if we want to look back around the D2C movement, right? Mm-hmm. So the experience innovation that the consumer was having was around cutting out the middleman, being more cost efficient.
Glasses for $100 instead of going to the,
exactly.
You know, that's great. That's good
exactly.
enough. Send them over.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And being purpose driven, buy one, get one. And, you know, the emotional driver there was around value, just saving money,
yep.
Being more missions aligned, wanting to help people. And obviously kind of the broader umbrella forcing function we saw there was the post-financial crisis. And so that's when we saw brands like Warby Parker come out and Everlane come out and Casper, is that they were, the DNA of those brands was the experience innovation around cutting out the middleman and being purpose-driven, coupled with the emotional driver of needing to save more money and wanting to help people. And so that kind of was, I feel like, what defined that moment.
So you're going to say a similar thing from this is going to come out of this time for the pandemic.
Well, right. And so then if we fast forward a little bit and look at the whole class of digitally native vertical brands, right? Like the experience innovation there was these were community first brands. Like these were brands that were digital first. Mm-hmm. They're all digital native. And the emotional drivers there were like confidence and sustainability and being empowered through a like-minded community. And I think that the forcing function there is around the Me Too movement,
sure.
Trump being elected, if we want to just keep it real.
Yep.
The climate strike that kind of all started. This is, again, I'm talking the like, call it 2014 to 2018 period. And so that's why we had brands like Billy that are so successful, that, you know, P&G tried to buy them and it got blocked by the FTC. It got challenged by the FTC. And we had Lively that got acquired by Wacol. And Lola came out. And so if we look at kind of that formula of experience innovation and emotional drivers with understanding these societal shifts that are happening, like what's happening today? Like what's happening in this moment in time around brand, right?
Right. And how is that going to shape the values of how people decide to make purchases?
Exactly. And so when when we've been thinking about future of brand, and I clearly can get down this wormhole for a while. So stop me if this is not interesting. But so as we kind of have been reflecting on what is this next crop of brands going to look like, the experience innovation that we see is really going to be around distribution convenience, right? So we've been quarantined and holed up. And so it's kind of this combination of distribution convenience with just destigmatizing accessibility to certain products and services.
Mm-hmm.
And this, the emotional drivers for people it's a sense of relief. It's a sense of feeling like your needs are being seen. It's a sense of feeling like you're not being judged for the products and the services that you need. It's celebrating your individuality. Yeah. And
at a time when everything was hard to control, felt like you had no control or didn't know where things were going. Those are really important to people.
Exactly. And obviously like the societal shift is around this post-COVID isolation. And I think a lot of the trauma that people are going to, that brands that are destigmatizing, you know, products and services that formerly came with shame or embarrassment, a little baggage, like they're just going to crush it. And so there's one company launching
sweatpants.
But I mean, I'm talking like in the period of care space, like there's one company that's about to launch called August that is just an unapologetic, like period care company. Mm-hmm. And this is a category that has no brand advocacy. Like, you know, most women, especially young women, you don't like identify with a certain tampon company.
Just functional.
But it's something obviously everybody needs. But then, you know, we also see things around creating a better distribution convenience for like mental health prescription medication, and delivery. You know, you see Parade, the underwear company, and it's just like, there's this new crop of brands that are just embracing that sense of making the customers feel seen for having to interact with those products and services. And again, that could be baldness, that could be period care, that could be mental health medication, like all these things that are a part of everyday life that the consumers previously, you know, I think were stigmatized in terms of how they interacted with that product and service. So that's kind of like just a really interesting insight that we've been seeing in terms of some of the brands we're excited about. And again, it's just kind of this recipe of experience innovation and the emotional drivers coupled with what is this moment in time that we're in right now,
mm-hmm.
To create these next chapters and these next eras of brands.
Speaking of a moment in time, I want to shift rat holes for a minute. As much as I'd love to talk about period care and women's underwear, I feel like it's going to be a trouble spot if I don't change soon. No, it's great. But it's funny, when we were going to talk, I dug up an article that I written where I quoted you back in 2017, which is not that long ago. We were talking about rocket fuel and how it was the end of an era for ad tech. And it's crazy at what has happened in the last few years, where you mentioned Triple Lift getting a huge amount of money. Companies going public, and it's not a disaster. The Trade Desk up until there was on fire, and so many deals are happening. Even though so much of the business model is up in the air, what in your mind from a distance, what happened? How did this happen?
Yeah, I mean, look, at the end of the day, I think that there's still a lot of creativity and upside to be had in the space. I think we're going to continue to see consolidation. We just saw Magnite close that $1 billion deal with SpotX, which I think is really interesting. And so I think that it just gets increasingly harder to go from zero to one in this space. And look, people talk about a cookieless future and IDFA and regulation and yada, yada. But like, look, the good ad tech companies, they knew this was coming, right? Like this is
right.
This is
hopefully,
not a,
they've
this
been
is not a surprise.
For quite a while, right?
Right, and if they're not, like that's probably they have bigger problems. Like none of this is new, and so I think that what we're seeing is just the result of a lot of planning and studying of the market landscape and the way regulations are changing, and that a lot of companies are coming out ahead because they took the time to plan. So I think that we are still in a cycle around just seeing interesting partnerships that can take place. I mean, which again, I think is just evident by Magnite and SpotX coming together. But I think we're going to see more and more of those, whether it's through SPACs or whether it's through just mergers or whether it's through consolidation. Right. I mean, I don't want to speculate and say like folks I think would make sense to come together, but
yes, let's marry people on like, this podcast. I like doing that.
Yeah. Right. But I think as, especially as people have been furloughed, as people just change platforms that they consume content on, it's just going to make sense to consolidate a lot of those workforces and a lot of that talent to continue to build and innovate, which is also obviously just pushing people into the creator economy, because it's also that sense of, okay, well, what are my skills and talents and how can I monetize that? Sure. Whether it's through a Substack if you're a writer, whether it's through like an anchor if you're a podcaster, whether it's through Patreon if you're an artist, like, there's just all these vertical platforms. So I do think that that's just going to be a continuation of what we're going to see in the months to come.
On that note, are you seeing any, are you seeing new ad tech companies emerge? Are there, when it comes to digital advertising, I'm assuming you're probably seeing pitches for audio startups or, you know, anybody that's talking about trying to unify the creator economy, but like what kind of action are you seeing?
Yeah, we're seeing a lot of innovation in the video space. So some of the things I've seen that are interesting is, you know, how can you really use computer vision to contextualize advertising? So for example, can you understand a soccer game that when somebody scores a goal, it pops up a certain brand that wants to be associated with those moments? So really moment-based advertising.
Interesting.
I think things like that are interesting. Obviously, we're seeing things around fan engagement and just loyalty plays. I always go back to with ad tech, something that I would just constantly get stuck on and continue to get stuck on, honestly, is for all the innovation that's happening out there, is it solving a real problem?
Yeah.
Like, or is this just an incremental improvement to an existing problem? Or can this really be something that can create a utility or a value for the customer? And that's an area where I constantly get stuck with marketing tech and with ad tech, is that there is a lot of innovation and there are a lot of creative solutions, but it's like, is it really going to move the needle if this brand can be associated with this moment, or like, is that really going to change ROI for that CMO?
Yeah.
And so I think that I see challenges in the landscape about that. And the other challenge that I see is, you know, is the technology too ahead of where marketing organizations are able to play?
We've seen that a lot.
I think we see that all the time. And that was honestly a frustration that I had spending so much time in the marketing tech spaces. You know, we would see incredibly interesting innovations, whether it was around voice commerce, connected devices, where AI, where it's like, okay, absolutely see how this can be transformative, but
is the marketer's
education and skill sets and infrastructure or data in a place where it will be ready to take advantage of this? And I think there's still a lot of those disconnects happening because we're just in an interesting inflection point of catching up skill sets and capabilities with the technology innovations that are happening.
Right. Yeah, you often have seen so many ad tech and martech companies just not realizing how slow moving big brands are.
Yeah.
Big brands can be. Although right now maybe that's changing. Jessica, I want to make sure we wrap on something before we let you go. Is I just want to talk about throughout your career, it seems like you've emphasized mentorship and trying to get more women into fields like venture capital technology.
Yes.
There's a lot of ways we can go there, but can you maybe talk about like some of your recent efforts and maybe what you'd like to see in any of these industries to happen to kind of push things forward faster?
Yeah, absolutely. So in 2015, I co-founded Women in BC, which today has become the world's largest community for women in venture capital. We've scaled it to over 3,000 women investors across more than 2,000 venture funds in 180 cities and over 60 countries. So it's really become the central infrastructure to help women around the world better connect, collaborate, create opportunities. We have an Airtable base, which really just helps you curate the venture community, and then also a Slack channel that has over 100 active channels. There's been over 100,000 messages. So, you know, this is everything from deal flow to job opportunities to just industry insights and best practices. And, you know, what we really realized when we started the community is absolutely we need more women in tech. We need more women in venture capital. But we also need to keep the founder. We have to keep the people we have in the community. And that really comes from having a strong support system and having strong role models. And so that's why we've put such an emphasis around creating that safe space for a lot of women that are the only woman in their firm or right. are the only woman in their local city or their local region. I mean, we have women from Pakistan to Dublin to Nashville to Buenos Aires that, you know, are able to just expand their knowledge base, expand their connections, and expand their deal flow. So it's pretty incredible, something that we're really passionate about. And then in terms of the need for mentorship and just how we want to see things evolve, look, there's been a lot of talk, there's been a lot of initiatives, there's been a lot of attention around the urgency to back female founders and minority founders, people of color founders, which 1,000% that is important, absolutely. But for all the emphasis that's been put on it, the numbers are not changing. The numbers are not improving fast enough, and they're not it's a rounding error in terms of what needs to happen, unfortunately. And so something we really have been talking about a lot is the more scalable way to fix diversity at the founder level is to go farther upstream to back women and minority fund managers, the people that are controlling the capital, to invest in them. And the reason that's important is because studies have already showed that women are twice as likely to back a female founder and 3 times more likely to back a female CEO. And so if we can empower women and minority managers to have larger funds, it enables them to invest in companies and investment themes that they believe are going to be transformative for the next generation, to help build products and services and opportunities to service those markets that tend to be overlooked.
So if you could channel your support to folks that can support a whole lot of people at once, that's going to have a more of a bigger impact.
Yep. Exactly.
Very cool. It's just, unfortunately, you made a great point. It's not easy for the women that break through to be the lonely person for a long time in their career. Yeah. You got to get them to stick around while you add to the pool of talent. Yeah. Well, super, super amazing, worthy stuff. Thanks for such an awesome session, Jessica. We covered a lot of ground, but this was terrific. And best of luck in your relatively new venture here.
Thank you. And I'm excited to be a resource and obviously a friend of the pod. And more opportunities to collaborate.
Don't be a stranger. We'll talk soon, hopefully. Thanks a lot.
Definitely. Thanks for having me.
A big thanks to my guests this week, Jessica Peltz, That You Love, founding partner of the venture capital firm Hannah Gray, and of course, my partners at AppsFlyer. If you like this episode, please take a moment to rate and leave a review. We have lots more to bring you, so be sure to hit the subscribe button. We'll see you next time for more on what's next in marketing.